Welcome aboard the Shipshape Podcast, your ultimate destination for marine wisdom and expertise. Our skilled crew, comprised of top boating journalists and experts, is committed to delivering informative and captivating content week after week. We're eager to connect with and learn from our fellow mariners, and we encourage you to share our podcast with your friends. Remember, word of mouth is our lifeblood. And if you enjoy an episode, please leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. By doing so, you're helping us forge a robust community of mariners who can learn, collaborate, and exchange their experiences out on the water.
Today on the Shipshape Podcast, we are talking with Andrew Guest, a man who has been contributing to the preservation and revival of the wooden boat community in ways that few others have. From his apprenticeship at the Carpenter's Boat Shop in Maine, to his role as ship carpenter on the iconic Mayflower II, and his current stewardship at the West Mystic Wooden Boat Company, Andrew's journey is one of passion, commitment, and a deep love for these timeless maritime vessels. Your two co-hosts today are Merrill Charette on the liveaboard on a Toshing Toshiba 36 in Boston, Massachusetts, and T.
Hey guys, welcome to the podcast. This is Talabati. I'm aboard my powerboat in Virginia, and we're going to be speaking with Andrew today and learning about wooden boats. Exciting stuff. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you so much.
So, Andrew, where are you recording this from?
I am recording this from the West Mystic Wooden Boat Company in Mystic, Connecticut.
And do I hear an accent? Are you from the U.S.?
Yes, but also no. I was born in the U.S., but both my parents are British nationals, so I have dual citizenship. I've lived in both places, and I have a very confused sense of my own nationality. Mm-hmm.
And so what brought you back to the U.S.? Was it the wooden boats?
So after university, I actually lived in Iceland briefly, but then I came back to the US to pursue an apprenticeship and went through the apprenticeship program at the Carpenter's Boat Shop in Pemaquid, Maine. This was 2012-2013. And pretty soon after that, managed to be hired to work on Mayflower II as ship's carpenter in Plymouth, Massachusetts.
Very interesting. And that's 10 years ago. Take us from the beginning, though. What happened before that? I understand you weren't always a carpenter.
I've always been a bit of a carpenter. I've always had a need to make things ever since I was a child. Always making things, helping my dad with projects around the house, carpentry and painting and all that sort of thing. But I didn't really get into wooden boats until I was at university in the UK. And basically, I started a project. It was about a lot of things, but one of the focuses of it was people that do what I do now and their boats and the history of all that and how that sort of ties into general maritime history and culture in the southwest of the UK. And I really fell in love with it. And I decided to kind of change routes in life at that point.
Well, as you have mentioned here, right, it's like the idea of boating is what kind of drove you to it and the legacy and the history of it. Can you talk a little bit more on what about boats really drove you to it?
Sure. It is, I think, the most complex form of carpentry, certainly one of the most complex, and that appeals to me. I like things with interesting complexity, and I've always been a massive history nerd, and it, you know, definitely ties in with that very well.
And though you're working on a boat, right, you know, the famous saying that we heard is some nail 'em and some sail 'em. So do you have any sailing experience, or were you like, I'm just going to build this wooden boat, go from there, like Acorn to Arabella?
I do have sailing experience, yes. And that has been another big drive, is wanting to live in that lifestyle, the long distance cruising lifestyle, which I really love. I love being able to very organically travel to distant places and bring my whole home and my workshop and everything with me. It feels very natural and very appealing. So yeah, I have done a fair bit of sailing, mostly in Europe, but some in US waters as well.
So why build your own boat? Like, why not just buy one off the shelf?
Well, I'm actually not strictly speaking, building this one. I'm restoring this one, very extensively restoring. It ends up pretty much being that I've built it. But this particular boat, her name is Rosalind. She was built in St. Ives, Cornwall. Cornwall's in the southwest of the UK. She was built in 1903 by guy named William Painter, who was... He was a bit of a local legend at the time, very talented boat builder, and this is the last surviving boat that he built in St. Ives. And there are only two other boats of this type left in the world that we know of anyway. So she's historically significant. She's very special, I think. This general type of boat is the type of boat that I have the most sailing experience with. I think I've done the most research on. I actually, years ago, I got awarded a research grant by the Center for Wooden Boats in Seattle to do a project on these boats. This was before this project. Yeah, I feel very strongly that they're significant and they're worth saving.
Well, what type of boat is this? And then could you give us kind of like a history lesson on this style boat?
Sure. So she's a Cornish lugger, specifically a St. Ives Cornish lugger, built for the mackerel fishery. So this is back in the days when fishing boats were sailboats, originally built engineless, so completely working off of sail power. They are, to me, very interesting in that the rig is very esoteric. It's a dipping lug rig. So the most noticeable part of that is that in order to tack or jibe, you actually have to lower the foresail to the deck and run it around the other side of the mast and then raise it again.
Which that is a pretty, like a lot of work. Yeah.
It is a pretty complicated maneuver, and to do it quickly, you need a lot of people, but you don't generally have to do it quickly because you have other sails, so the boat's still driving while you're doing that. But what that gets you is a really surprisingly high-performance sail shape that has a low center of effort, so the boat correspondingly doesn't have to be as deep to counterbalance the rig, which means less wetted surface area, which means the boat's faster. And so they're surprising in their level of performance, given how old and traditional they are.
Yeah, as you've mentioned, you're kind of like building the boat slash it was already kind of around. Where did you find this place and you find this boat in the first place? And what condition was it in when you found it?
So I heard about this boat through work from Walt Ansell, actually, who's a bit of a local legend here, a very talented shipwright that I worked with when I worked at Mystic Seaport. And he had heard that this boat existed, and he and all my other coworkers knew of my interest in this type. This boat was in Maryland, on the eastern shore in Oxford, Maryland, and she had been brought across the Atlantic, actually, in a barge on a barge carrier in the 1970s by the previous owner. So I'll talk about the previous owner in a bit. It's a bit of a character, he was, apparently. I never met him, but when I came into the picture, he had passed away, and the boat was just sitting on the hard. And the yard there was trying to figure out what to do about it. They were gearing up to cut her up.
That's sad.
Because obviously no one was paying for her to be there anymore. And Richard Griffiths was his name. Shortly after Richard passed away, the boat actually sank a couple of times at the dock. And they had to haul her out again. And so they were tired of it, understandably. Mm. But fortunately, I heard about her sort of in the nick of time and managed to arrange transport up here up to Mystic.
I had a friend who got an abandoned boat for a case of beer. What'd you pay?
£1.
I knew that's coming.
Yeah, nice. £1 just to make it a legal transfer. Mm-hmm. And that agreement was with Richard's son. He was very pleased that somebody actually wanted to take her on and that she was going to survive, as have been a lot of other people, which has been really gratifying. It's really helped keep momentum. But it's not just for me, it's for other people as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're preserving a legacy there. And so I just want to take you a step back. You were telling us about your boat. What's your draft like on this? You said it's not too deep.
6 feet.
That's not bad for a 40-foot vessel.
Yeah, for a big 40-foot vessel, that's really not bad. And part of the reason for that is also that the tidal range where she's from is pretty extreme. At spring tides, it's about 7 meters. All of the harbors in Cornwall dry out on the tide. So boats built there have to be built to sit on the bottom half the day.
Oh.
And particularly in St. Ives, well, in a lot of other places that are more sheltered, you can actually bolt legs onto the sides of your boat so that they don't fall over, and then you ship the legs when you're going off sailing. You put them on board and then you go off. But in St. Ives is relatively exposed to the Irish Sea. It's a sandy harbor, so sand doesn't agree with legs terribly well, and the harbor was also completely packed back in the day, so there were just hundreds of boats in the harbor, all sort of jostling against each other, and apparently legs would just get ripped off. So that very much influenced the hull shape. She's very, very sharp forward and has a very deep tuck aft, but then is very flat floored amidships. So what that means is that she's really able to sit on the bottom very easily without leaning over very far.
So there's no keel per se then, or is there?
There is, yeah. No, okay. There's a keel. But it's not a particularly heavily built keel. It's like 5.5 inches wide by, the keel itself is, I think, protrudes about six or seven inches. But then I've got like a 3-inch worm shoe on the bottom of that. So not enormous.
Very interesting. Yeah. And how many sails does this rig have? Masts, I mean.
Sure. Two masts, a bowsprit and an outrigger or a boomkin. So she's able to set, let me see, there's a mizzen topsail. You can set a mizzen staysail, a forelug, and a jib, potentially. To have all of those set, it'd have to be pretty light airs, but...
Mm-hmm. But that would just give you that classic sort of movie picturesque sort of.
Oh, yeah.
They imagine when, right?
They're stunning. They're absolutely stunning when they're under full sail.
Mm.
So obviously, when you have a used boat, the boat tends to give you unique problems. So what yes. have been some of the biggest challenges that you faced with this boat?
Well, I mean, generally, just the state she was in very, very poor shape. When I got her, she was already 114 years old and was really showing it. She's 120 now, though there's only a couple of pieces that are actually that old that are left. I've replaced almost everything. I think one of the most amusing challenges was the level of galvanic problems that the boat had. Galvanic problems being interaction of dissimilar metals that are connected by an electrolyte, which is seawater, is conductive. So the further apart different metals are on the galvanic scale, the more of a problem you'll have. And I'm sure you guys are familiar with putting zincs on your boat to protect different things. The zinc gets eaten before almost anything else, right? Because it's quite far on the scale away from everything else. Richard, he always had a hard time getting good ballasts. Ballast is expensive. She really needs, I think, around 5.5 tons. So like it really adds up. So he kind of begged and borrowed off of people and got just all kinds of random stuff to ballast her with. Scrap iron and some bits of lead. There were steam bucket teeth. There were lots of those sash weights from sash windows. There was a wheel off of a railroad car. Just all kinds of stuff. But the part that became an issue over the years was he had about 1,600 pounds of zinc in the form of molds to make the soles of high-heeled shoes.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, it was kind of an interesting thing to discover. But the upshot of that is that every place that there was a bolt or a nail or a screw, the wood around those, because of the like the galvanic electrical action between all of these dissimilar metals, like the wood just fell apart. It looked almost like it melted. So that's, I think, the biggest reason that there is so little that I could actually save was that sort of galvanic degradation of things.
So just to clarify, Andrew, most people want minimum extra weight on their boat. You're saying the previous owner tried his best to get the heaviest things he could find onto his boat.
For ballast. So production built boats are typically built with ballasts, typically bolted to the underside of a keel or as a ballast keel. This type of boat is built to have internal ballast. So this would be iron pigs or lead pigs or scrap metal or concrete as well. I've managed to replace all of the ballasts, metal ballast, with lead and encapsulated it in concrete, which is for a couple of reasons. One is the weight, but the biggest one is actually helping limbering, as it's called, which is allowing water that comes into the boat to drain freely to where the pump is. Either you need what's called limber hulls, which are on the bottom of the floor timbers that allow water to sort of run up and down the keel, or you need to fill the space in between the floor timbers with something so that it can flow over the top, which is what I've done.
Interesting.
Well, let me ask you this. If you have an old ship and you replace every plank on it, is it still the same ship?
Well, legally, yes. So the criteria, and I think this is from Lloyd's of London, which is like one of the big boat insurance companies that's existed forever. I believe it's their criteria that as long as at no point there was no boat and at no point there was two boats, legally it is the same boat. Those are valid approaches to restoration as well. Like sometimes a boat is so degraded that all you can do is carefully record the shape and then start building a new one next to it and like use the old one as a template almost. That's totally valid, but like then legally, I guess, is less considered to be the same boat. I don't know quite how I feel about that. And that's definitely not the approach. I took the approach of replacing one piece at a time very, very carefully to preserve the shape. She was a mess.
So tell us more about insurance, because I remember I had an older boat, no one near as old as yours. It was a 1969 boat. It was actually the first production fiberglass boat. You know, the hull was 3 inches thick and it was like totally wood inside, and then they like coated it with fiberglass. But I remember even that wasn't easy to insure. And I remember somebody else who had a 50-foot wooden boat, and I remember they were telling me their horror stories. Nobody wanted to insure it. So how did that whole chapter work out?
Honestly, I'm afraid I've already said everything I know about insurance. It's definitely not an area of expertise of mine that I have all that to look forward to.
Okay. So this is more of then don't just hit anything.
Yeah, basically. Or yeah, do your best, I suppose. I intend to look into it when the time comes, but from what I've heard from other people, it's probably a no-go.
As long as you stay on the high seas, I think it'll be okay, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, just eternally sailing around the world.
Yeah.
How has your perception of time and history changed since you started immersing yourself in wooden boats and kind of the history of it?
Well, it's definitely the biggest hands-on historical project I've ever done. Really, it's been marine archaeology, taking this boat apart one piece at a time, recording things, making new pieces based off of old pieces. You learn things about the way the builder went about things all those years ago. You find interesting artifacts like women's shoe molds. Then you see the progression over time as well. You know, this is not the first work that's ever been done on this boat, obviously, at her age. So there are different eras that you kind of uncover as you get into it, which I find really interesting. Richard had this boat from 1959 until he passed away in 2016. So over the course of his stewardship, a lot of work was done at different times of different types. So uncovering all of that was quite interesting, I thought.
So Andrew, in your previous life, I understand you're a photographer. How has that helped with all of this?
Probably not as much as it should have. I was saying before, actually, I tend to get very wrapped up in the work and very focused on the work, and I forget to document it. I'm always trying to set up a camera when I'm doing something significant. I take quite a lot of still photographs, but I've really struggled to keep up with video. Thankfully, I've had help with that from my friend Anne, who is probably who spoke to at Acorn Terrabella, actually. She's helped a lot with videos and helped me get a YouTube channel up and going. So I'm endlessly grateful to her.
Mm.
And how big is the community of wooden boat builders? Are you guys talking to everyone that's working on a wooden boat? Or
probably not everybody, but it is. It's not an enormous community, so we do generally at least know of each other. And I know a lot of people that work in this area doing this kind of thing. there's a couple of people that I really, really respect and trust their advice about my specific weird problems that I, I solicit advice from now and again if I come across something that I haven't done before, which is great. You know, it's really, really nice that we all kind of share knowledge that way, I think.
It's making a comeback, just like wooden boats?
Oh, yeah. I think that after, you know, 1940s, 1950s was kind of the end of, like, large-scale commercial use of wooden boats, and it definitely had a slump after that, but there's a lot of interest in wooden boats and a lot of people learning how to care for them. I think it's a growing community. I definitely don't subscribe to the idea that it's endangered. I definitely haven't seen that.
Mm-hmm. And I've seen people build sort of smaller stuff in their backyard, like a dinghy or something, and sure. Then, you know, get motivated to do a bigger project or something, a passion project like you're doing. Tell us a little bit more about the Mayflower or even the other projects that you did and how some of those learnings helped you do what you're doing now.
Oh, sure. I learned a lot working on Mayflower. So, I mean, my previous experience was on boats the size of mine. So, you know, up to, I think, you know, the largest one that I sailed on was like 80 feet. And, you know, I'd mostly worked on, you know, 40 to 50 foot boats. And then at my apprenticeship, it was all very much smaller boats, you know, dinghies for the most part. So working on Mayflower 2, I learned a lot about big timber construction. And I'm really thankful that I had that experience. I actually was part of a two-man team that built the new stem assembly for Mayflower 2 when she was being restored at Mystic Seaport, which was an enormous assembly. So like the inner stem was two pieces of live oak. Live oak is like premium North American shipbuilding timber. It comes from the deep south. It's incredibly rot resistant, incredibly hard, holds fasteners really well, very dense, very heavy. Each of these pieces was nearly a ton, and we had to get a joint between them so tight that you couldn't get a piece of paper between. And it was a curved joint as well. And then the outer stem was, I think, I want to say it was four pieces, and it's kind of the same story, but in North American white oak, very complicated joints in very, very large pieces of wood. And I think that has definitely helped a lot with my personal work and work on other people's boats. Just like, if you can do it at that scale, you can scale it down. And yeah, very, very valuable learning experiences.
So how do you navigate the emotional highs and lows that come with dedicating years to this project?
Oh gosh. with some difficulty sometimes. The support of my family, the support of my friends, and the support of everyone around the world that cares about what I'm doing has been huge to keep momentum going. If it was just me in isolation, I don't think I'd still be doing it. Knowing that it matters to a lot of people, I think, is the biggest thing.
And how have you managed to balance kind of preserving the historical authenticity of the boat and, you know, modern equipment and requirements during this whole restoration?
Sure. That's a very good question. And I've taken a very mixed approach because while I have a deep interest in history and archaeology and preservation and all these things, I also intend to live on this boat and go sailing. So there's kind of two big considerations there. And sometimes there are odds. For instance, I did a plywood and fiberglass deck because I like adding that enormous amount of strength into the hull. I think over the long term, it's the best thing for, you know, long-term health of the boat because it won't leak. Fresh water leaking through the deck is typically what kills a wooden boat. Mm. It's that sweet water, as they call it. It's fresh water from rain and condensation and all that is what can feed the rot fungus and really gets it started. So
interesting. Like, who would have thought, right? The salt water is not the enemy in this case.
No, salt water is actually fairly good for a wooden boat because, you know, salt is a decent preservative. Salt in contact with fungus kills the fungus. What you do run into with salt water is all the things that live in salt water that like to eat wood, which is a whole other thing. But yeah, so, you know, plywood and fiberglass deck, I'm going to have a pretty robust electrical system on board because I want to be able to run power tools. I'm not restoring the interior to how she would have been because she was a fishing boat. She would have had a fish hold, a net room, mm-hmm. you know, all that sort of thing, which is not something I need for my purposes. But I've restored the hull shape, sort of the deck configuration for the most part, and the rig will be restored to how she originally was. And I think it feels like a pretty decent compromise to me.
Ahoy, investors! Are you on the lookout for a unique opportunity to invest in a thriving industry? Set your sights on Shipshape, the innovative platform connecting boat and yacht owners with top-notch marine service providers. Our team is committed to revolutionizing the marine repair and refit market in North America. But we can't sail these seas alone. With your support, we can enhance our platform and create a significant impact in the industry. Don't let this exciting investment opportunity drift away. Contact us today to learn more about joining our voyage. Reach out to us at info@shipshape.pro.
Andrew, again, you've been doing this for like 10 years on your own, but like maybe take us even further back. How have like some of the technologies, maybe like since this boat was made to like now, how have they changed, and some of the materials, how have they changed? Like you said, we got power tools now, but what else?
Sure. Plywood is a big thing, and plywood comes from advances in adhesives, which has been the other huge, huge advance since 1903 is, you know, in 1903, there weren't glues that worked in a marine environment, really. Mm. You had pitch. So, you know, a formulation of tar that you heat up and then it will cool to a solid. It kind of works as a glue, but only kind of. Whereas now we have resorcinols, we have epoxies, we have urea formaldehyde, we have all kinds of things that potentially can work in a marine environment. And that's great. It allows all kinds of things. And it's kind of become essential because of the change in the timber industry. It is no longer really possible to get lengths of wood sensibly over about 20 feet.
Why is that?
20 feet is the bed length of a standard portable sawmill these days. So unless you buy a 20-foot bed extension, that's as long as you can cut. And that, like a portable sawmill is how most boat building timber gets cut these days. Mm-hmm. The only way of cutting things longer than that that's accessible to people like me is a chainsaw mill, which I do have, and I have used a lot. Not so much for cutting long stuff, but for cutting really curved stuff. It's really good. So this is a mechanism that actually bolts onto the bar of a large chainsaw and allows you to parallel cuts with a chainsaw very precisely. It's pretty grueling, especially when you're cutting hardwood, but it does work. Chainsaws are a big thing since 1903 too, that allows all sorts of things that weren't possible before. So, you know, power tools, adhesives. Yeah. Oh, and yeah, I was saying advances in adhesives have become very important because of this length of timber issue. Mm. What you end up having to do is glue up a piece to get the length you need. Mm. And it's fairly standard practice now to glue up masts and spars as well, partially because of length and partially because then you can build them hollow, which reduces weight aloft, which improves everything, really.
That sounds a little scary, though. A hollow, glued-together mast.
It's actually really, really strong. I'm not totally up on the physics of this, but the way that tension and compressive forces work on a spar, it being solid doesn't actually give you any more strength. That wood in the middle doesn't really get you anything other than weight, which you don't necessarily want. So, yeah, it's pretty standard practice to glue them up hollow. That also allows you to do things like run electrical and radar and things like that up the middle, which are, you know, things that, I mean, like mast headlights, you have to have now. And, you know, if it's a solid spar, you have to basically route a groove all the way up to run the wiring and then cap it. So you're still gluing something up, and you might as well cut down on the weight while you're at it.
When you look at this whole career of boat building and wooden boats, what personal transformations have you noticed within yourself?
Oh, gosh. Some good and some bad. My health has suffered a bit I had a really bad injury working on Mayflower 2. I had a fall and wrecked my shoulder and my lower back. So I had to have shoulder surgery, and I've had to adapt some of the ways that I work to the realities of that. You know, my shoulder's back to like 85%, I think, but you know, it's not 100%. So I have to be careful with it. So I've had to do things more carefully and methodically, which is not a bad thing at all. It's just, it's a change, you know. I've had to set up all kinds of ways of lifting things and supporting things that will allow me to, you know, work with my physical limitations and honestly to work with working alone too, which, you know, typically this is not the sort of thing that is done alone. And for the most part, I have done the work alone. So definitely some adaptation has been needed for that. Yeah, I don't know. I like to think I'm older and wiser. Remains to be seen. But yeah.
So, Andrew, just sort of building off that, take us through what like an average day looks like in the life of Andrew.
Well, apart from my project, I'm the caretaker at West Mystic Windboat. So depending on what's going on, what the weather is, what part of the season we're in, I have some responsibilities to do with that, whether it's helping people launch and retrieve their boats or general, you know, yard work around the place, general tidying and you know, making sure that passersby aren't in dangerous areas and that they know that it's a working boat yard and all that kind of thing. But with my work, you know, I'm at the moment getting going pretty early in the morning, trying to get something bolted to the boat every day, you know, just taking it one piece at a time. I actually got one of the bulwark planks steamed on this morning before this. So that was good.
Nice. Yeah. And so it's just basically chipping away every day.
Yeah, just chipping away. Just repeating that mantra of one piece at a time. It's very easy to get overwhelmed looking at the whole, but you know, just focusing on the one piece at a time really helps. Right now, I'm working on bulwark construction, which is sort of the railing around the deck. I'm also working on construction of the cabin top, which has been a lot of lamination, which is another big change due to adhesives since 1903, is that you're able to laminate things. So these are pretty extremely curved, or cambered is the word that you'd use, beams that hold up the top of the cabin top. And they're curved enough that it would be very difficult to actually find wood that grew that shape. So the best way of getting that shape is to cut lots of thin strips of wood and bend them over a mold with glue. And once the glue is set, it holds the shape. So I've been doing a lot of that. Starting to think about some systems installation with my engine and windlass, particularly. Starting to think about gluing up my foremast as well. I managed to score a massive spruce tree last summer that had come down in somebody's yard down in Western Connecticut. I drove down to Western Connecticut to get it and milled it up. And it's just about seasoned and ready to get glued up. So that will be sort of the next project once bulwarks are done.
You said it didn't originally, the designs didn't have any engine or anything. How have you worked around that? Like, it's from scratch. What does that involve?
Well, originally she didn't have an engine, but by 1918, she would have had her first engine put in. And actually, over the course of her working life and Richard's stewardship, if I'm remembering right, she's had 9 different engines.
Wow. And now you're doing electric?
Did it start with steam?
No, it would actually probably started with a petrol paraffin engine, which is not something that's really around anymore. But and then going over to diesel, which is what I've gone with, is a diesel. Actually, it's a diesel engine that was very kindly given to me by Steve at Acorn to Arabella. It's actually the engine out of Victoria, which is the similar boat that he bought mostly for parts. And he was very kind and gave me the engine because he wasn't going to use it. He was going to get a new one. So, yeah, it was interesting taking the hull apart, finding all of this evidence of previous engines. Because basically every time they put a new engine in, they bored a new prop shaft bore and then plugged the old one. So there were all these plugs everywhere. Yeah, I think there were 6 or 7 on the port side, 1 on the starboard side, and a center shaft. lots of engine history.
Well, as we come to our conclusion here, can you kind of tell us what the future of this boat is, and kind of do you have any timelines in your head of when it's going to be completed?
Sure. I'm hoping to launch about this time next year. She won't be finished in all likelihood, but will be afloat at least. The work will continue, and hopefully within a year or two after that, she'll be ready to go. I have different ideas about our future is going to look like. I definitely want to go off sailing for a while. I'd like to pursue some licensing so that I can use the boat commercially, which I need a bunch of current sea time for. All of my sea time's ages and ages ago, and I don't think is applicable. So
it'll come back quick.
Press sea time, get licensed, and then ultimately what I'd really like to do with her is running cargo under sail. Which sail cargo is a growing movement in the environmentalist community. I have all sorts of friends that are involved in different sail cargo projects. And I think that this boat, while she's not very big for doing that kind of work, she's big enough. And I think her being relatively shallow drafted and being able to dry out on a tide happily will give me access to ports that are not accessible to other people.
For sure.
Which I think there might be a niche for, but we shall see.
Our listeners love sort of hearing tips and tricks. What sort of wisdom would you share with them? You know, how to maybe even get involved, make their own boat? You know, any resources you might recommend?
Well, resources, there's a couple of websites. There's a website that I'm blanking on the name of it, that's partially run by a grant from the European Union, and I think a grant from somewhere else. Anyway, there's all these videos about different aspects of large boat work and work on dinghies and things like that. All, you know, wood and steel, both they have videos on. YouTube is honestly an enormous resource. I definitely wouldn't discount YouTube for that.
But yeah, gratifying, you would recommend this experience to others as well?
I think if you have a passion for it, if it's something that eats away at you and drives you, then definitely do. I can't really imagine, like, as difficult as this has been, I can't really imagine not having done it. I know it's not for everybody, but I would. For the subset of people that have, you know, an interest in history, an interest in hands-on engineering, all that sort of thing, absolutely I would, yeah.
So, Andrew, where can people find you and see more about what you're doing?
Well, I have a YouTube channel I think it's just youtube.com/restoringRosalind. I have a website also, which I need to update, but which is, I'm going to have to spell this out for you because it's in Cornish, but it's Bisnawith Boatworks. Bisnawith means new world in the Cornish language. So that's Bisnawydh Boatworks.
Very cool.
And I'm also on Instagram. Yeah, I'm all over the place. So,
very cool. Well, best of luck in all your wooden boat adventures, and I hope you inspire like a whole new generation of boat builders. Because you know what I heard the other day is that they're sending wooden satellites into space. They're like, hey, wood works really well in space. So
yeah, I've read about that. I mean, wood is an amazing material, and I think I don't have formal training in this, but I have a deep interest in wood technology, wood as a construction material. And I read about, you know, its use in satellites because I'm also a huge nerd about space flight and space exploration. And, you know, its applications for things like that, I think are really interesting. And the fact that it's, you know, if it's cared for, it's endlessly renewable, I think is really important and just going to become more and more important as time goes on.
Well, Andrew, I mean, the fact that the boat's already, 120 years old, it just needs to make it a few more 100 years, and then soon there'll be a guy putting some rocket engines on it.
Yeah.
Well, I can only hope.
Yeah, awesome. Great speaking with you, Andrew.
Yeah. You too. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Check back every Tuesday for our latest episode. And be sure to like, share, and subscribe to ShipShape.pro.